I'm Eric Decker, and this is the Jets Blog Podcast.
Welcome back to the Jets Blog Podcast. I'm your host, Corey Griffin, and Brian Bassett is not on the other line. He is apparently preoccupied with his children to come on this show. So just so you all know, Brian Bassett's children are more important than you, the loyal listener, loyal reader of thejetsblog.com, more important than me, his friend for longer than these children have been alive. But it's okay. I won't take it personally. Thankfully, we have an able co-host slash guest on the other line. You know him as Brian Costello of the New York Post. Brian, thank you for jumping on and filling in with me.
No problem. I'm shocked at that Bassett's skipping out on this. Is this voluntary or is this mandatory?
It's voluntary in the CBA of the show, but he will be fined under the table for not showing up.
Good. It's like the Mangini rules of the old days. So that's good.
Yeah. That seems like a good place to start. So how much are the Jets going to fine Eric Decker for showing a sign of solidarity?
Nah, he won't be fined. I mean, I think Todd Bowles has made it clear in the last 2 years he doesn't think much of OTAs. Every answer he usually gives is they're in shorts, you know, and he kind of dismisses everything he sees out there as they're in shorts. So I think he'll be fine with some of his veterans not showing up for the voluntary portion of the spring program.
Yeah, we're referring to Eric Decker not showing up to OTAs. Brian, you reported, according to a source, that it was in part for solidarity with Ryan Fitzpatrick remaining unsigned. Brandon Marshall also absent, although you reported that that is a completely different thing and not related to Ryan Fitzpatrick's absence. But the spin is that Fitzpatrick's absence, as he remains a free agent, is you know, stirring up some trouble or at least stirring up some issues where people are concerned at this point. You know, we're in the practices, we're starting to get closer to training camp. It's going to be here before you know it. And Geno Smith is the number one in name only. Let's start with the wide receivers, their relationship with Fitzpatrick, and how long do you think Eric Decker's quote-unquote protest is going to go on?
You know, I think the relationship is extremely close between Decker, Marshall, and Fitzpatrick. They really clicked last year. They really hit it off. I think it's gone beyond the field. We've seen a bunch of those guys went to the Rangers game in April. You know, Decker was with Fitzpatrick in that one. And, you know, one of the lasting image for me of last season at the end was the day after the Buffalo game. You know, we go in there to do the final interviews for the season. And we're in the locker room, and there's boxes and bags everywhere. And as we were being taken out of the locker room when they were closing it, the last two guys I saw in the locker room were Fitzpatrick and Marshall. And they were just sitting at Marshall's locker, BSing, you know, and you could tell that these guys are really tight and there's a strong relationship there. So, you know, I think it's clear. Everyone you talk to with the Jets who isn't another quarterback wants Fitzpatrick to be the quarterback this season. It's just a matter of getting the dollars worked out. And in terms of the, you know, Decker, I wouldn't be shocked if he's back this week. I know he has a camp in New Jersey on Saturday next week. So I would think he'd be back here. And I think if he's, you know, if he does come back, he made his little statement. But what was kind of stunning, you know, when we were out there is Decker, Marshall, and Mangold, who we later found out, you know, his wife had a baby. Those guys are always at all. You know, Marshall had only seen for a year, but he was always at the OTAs last year. And I can only really remember Decker missing one OTA since he's been here when his wife was involved in a country music award show, and he missed that one. But these guys are hard workers, and they don't mind being out there doing the work. So it was kind of surprising not to see them the other day. And then that's what kind of led to all the reporting afterwards. So
yeah, it
wouldn't shock me if Decker's back this week.
Fair. You know, what's it's remarkable is, you know, you mentioned, you know, not seeing Marshall and Decker and Mangold there. And it's something that I think anyone that pays attention to the team notices. It's how just remarkably top heavy this team is at certain key positions. You know, when Ryan Fitzpatrick isn't there, Geno Smith is your number one. When Marshall and Decker aren't there, Kenbrell Tompkins is starting out wide in starting in quotes in OTAs. You know, when Mangold isn't there and, you know, they're moving Dakota Dozier inside the center.
Yeah.
It's a team that feels a hair trigger of a hamstring away from being in dire straits in a lot of weird spots.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm so focused on the Jets, and you are as well. I don't know if it's like this on the 31 other teams. I'd have to really examine rosters. But to me, you know, covering this team now for 6-7 years, it feels like it's been like that a lot. You know, back in the Tannenbaum days, that's kind of where they were, was they had all these big contract guys, you know, and then they had a drop-off on depth, and it feels like that sort of now, too. There's not really a middle class. There's the guys who are, like, developing players who were draft picks from the last few years, and then there are the top players, and then there's a few of those fill-in guys, you know, Steve McClendon or those types of guys that they signed this year to lesser deals. But for the most part, if you're either, you know, one of these top guys, or you're a developing, unproven guy. So, yeah, you're right. It's very, very tenuous situation on a lot of positions. You know, I mean, Ryan Clady, to me, that's the one that's like, he better stay healthy, or it doesn't matter if he's playing quarterback.
Yeah, things could get really bad if Ryan Clady's foot or knee or a leg or any sort of hip or what, a shoulder. If anything acts up on Ryan Clady, the left tackle, and whoever is starting at quarterback is in serious trouble. Let's talk a little bit more about OTAs, and we'll move on to some other stuff. You know, look, they're in shorts. It's not serious. I personally kind of loathe this time of year. I pretty much hate everything from the end of January until August. But, you know, it does matter to some degree. You know, you see guys like a Bishop, like Freddie Bishop, will stand out, as he did during rookie minicamp with all the glorious headlines that were written about him. Who stood out, you know, as much as they could in practice the last couple of days?
Well, we're allowed to watch one. We only watch Wednesday, so we're allowed to watch each Wednesday. So that was the first one. So, I mean, it's hard for me to pick somebody out. You know, obviously we were ultra focused on the quarterbacks, and Gino had a really good day. He looked good. He was throwing the ball well, had a really nice deep pass to Kembrell Tompkins. He jumped out to me. Amaro, I was watching a little bit, and he made some nice catches. You know, you're always kind of thinking in the back of your mind, is he going to drop it? And he made some nice catches in there. And so those guys were really stood out to me. But like you said, I mean, it was May 25th when we were watching. It's hard to gauge too much off of that.
Yeah, no, it's fair. Gino is interesting to me, and it's, I'm sure as you see, it's this constant debate on Jets Twitter. It's what is Gino Smith? What could he be? Is there, you know, potential in him and in Chan Gailey's offense? And he has all the physical tools. You'll see people Vine or GIF or all show all these plays that show off some of his traits.
Yeah.
If the worst case scenario happens, let's say for some reason Mark Sanchez and Paxton Lynch break their legs in the next 2 months, and Denver just goes, here, Ryan Fitzpatrick, take $15 million. Just please don't force us to start Trevor Siemian. What kind of situation are the Jets looking at if Geno Smith is the week one quarterback?
I wish I could answer that question. I don't think anyone knows the answer to that. You know, is he the guy that you saw in 2013 and 14 that, you know, wasn't making great decisions, and, you know, but you could argue he didn't have Brandon Marshall on one side and Eric Decker on the other, that he had Decker for the second year, but not the first. But, you know, that combination, he didn't have Chan Gailey. Like you said, he was in Morningwood's system, which was different. You know, you see off flashes with Geno, the game in Miami, that last game, he had a perfect quarterback rating, but there was just so much inconsistency in his game. To me, I don't know. People always say, oh, guys develop at different pace. I don't know. I think once you see them on the field, guys don't change all that much. There's a few exceptions to that rule, but, you know, it's not like he's a guy that's had 2 years to watch and now you're going to see him. You know, he was thrown into the fire. You can kind of see what he could do. I don't know how much different Geno Smith will be. And the way the Jets schedule sets up in those first 2 months, it's not going to be very easy for whoever's the quarterback. And I just wonder, you know, Geno's going to have to build up some confidence with his teammates. I don't think he's going to have to overcome this thing if he's taking over Fitzpatrick, because we've seen how popular Fitzpatrick is. And I think there's going to be a lot of guys that are upset that Fitzpatrick isn't there. Not that they're going to blame Geno, but Geno's going to have to win the confidence of his teammates in the same way Fitzpatrick did last year when he took over for Geno. So I don't know what it's going to look like on September 11th if Geno Smith is the quarterback. It'll be fascinating if that plays out.
I'm of two minds on this. I'm of the mind that, you know, yes, there are different development tracks, and we've seen the physical tools, and his top wide receivers his first 2 years were David Nelson and Jeremy Curley. So, you know, you have to give him some level
Decker's second year.
So, but you have to give him some, you know, some little bit of a pause or whatever you want to call it for that. But like you said, you know, my complaint about Christian Hackenberg, the pick, was that if, you know, if a quarterback is scattershot, struggles with pressure, and is not super accurate in college, rarely do they go up a level and then become accurate, poised quarterbacks who slide easily in the pocket and deal with the pressure of winning an NFL game. So I almost want to see it happen just to see what happens, just to see if the development track is real, almost as a social experiment. Or, and because I will move off the quarterbacks after this, but this team isn't going to the Super Bowl this year. I know that there are a lot of people that live in this world where every year you should try to win the Super Bowl. We don't live in that world. The NFL can pitch parity all they want, but there are really about six or seven teams that have a legitimate shot to win the Super Bowl. The Jets aren't one of them. Could they make the playoffs and make a run if things break right? Possibly. They could also win seven or eight games with a tough schedule and play about as well as they did last year. It's just a weird situation, and I'm kind of getting tired of talking about it. But the funny thing is that this whole quarterback mess with Fitzpatrick and Geno and the Jets and all that has kind of made the Muhammad Wilkerson story bullet, an aftermath. And I thought that was going to be the story that drove us nuts this summer. And it has it's become a non-story, which just fascinates me. I'm a little amazed by that.
I think there's two elements at play. One, Fitzpatrick is the story because he's a quarterback. So that's going to dominate the headlines. And his future is really uncertain, his immediate future with Mo. Even if they don't work out a contract, everyone's pretty certain he's going to be in a Jets uniform in September. He'll sign the franchise tender, and he'll play under the tender for this year. So it's not like there's something imminent happening. But there also is no indication that there's any movement there toward a long-term deal. So there's not a whole lot to focus on right now where, you know, you have this drama with Fitzpatrick with he wants – $15 million. They're offering $7 million. Like, you know, there's nothing like that going on with Mo. I know they offered him a deal at the combine right before they put the tag on him, but that's the last time I've heard of any real negotiation between the two sides. So I just don't think the Jets are working toward a deal with him. So there's not a whole lot to focus on right now.
Yeah. Do we know what the value? Like, do we know how far apart they are essentially? Are there any
I don't know.
Figures?
I don't know the numbers from that one, but the sense I got is they're pretty far apart. And this was before the deals that people got in free agency, the Olivier Vernon deal, the Malik Jackson deal, these defensive line deals that really blew up the market even further. So, you know, to me now, Mo is pointing at that Olivier Vernon deal and saying, okay, that's where we're starting, you know, because the argument always was, oh, he's not J.J. Watt. You know, he's not J.J. Watt. Doesn't deserve J.J. Watt money. Guess what? Olivier Vernon is making more money than J.J. Watt.
I know.
Mo's better than Olivier Vernon. So, you know, I know fans, I've particularly heard with Fitzpatrick, have gotten into saying, well, it doesn't matter what other guys get. Nonsense. You know, if you're shopping for a house on a street where all the houses are $400,000, you can't offer $200,000 and expect to get a house. Like, it's comparable. Yeah, you have to look at what other guys are getting and go off of that.
Yeah, no, it's a totally fair point. It's a fair analogy. Last very brief question, then we'll move off of football stuff. I don't expect Mo to show up for OTAs. I honestly don't even expect him to show up for minicamp, even though it's quote unquote it is actually technically mandatory.
Not for him though, because he hasn't signed his contract. So
right,
not
exactly.
Contract. Yeah, he won't be fined for that.
We'll get plenty of holdout versus non-holdout tweets/arguments from Andrew Brandt about how Mo Wilkerson is not technically a holdout, even though people will call him a holdout because he's not signed. Should we expect him in training camp, or is this something that he's going to show up when he absolutely has to?
I think we'll see him in training camp. I'm not sure if you'll see him on day one of training camp. I think, you know, maybe he makes a statement by sitting out a week or something like that. You know, the worst part of training camp for these players is those first 2 weeks before the preseason starts, and none of them want to go through training camp there. So maybe Mo sees this as an opportunity, like, hey, you know what, I'm gonna wait, and maybe he shows up right around when the first preseason game is and doesn't play in that game, but then starts working toward, and he can play in like the third preseason game and just get a tune up. I think Mo will realize, you know, especially coming off a broken leg, wherever that is at that point, that he'd probably need a little bit of time to tune up before the season starts. I could see him sitting out a little bit and then showing up and being ready to play in the third preseason game.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, enough football. One of the things, and I put out this question on Twitter, and I got a lot of great responses, but one of the things that I want to do with this show, and I get to do it because Brian's not here, you guys, you and all the rest of the beat writers and a lot of football writers, I think have become these faceless Twitter accounts and bylines. And people yell at you online. I mean, they yell at everyone online, but they yell at you guys online a lot. And I don't think they know, you know, who you guys are, how you got into this, why you do this, what interests you. So I want to try to make this show, especially in the summer when we all don't want to talk about Ryan Fitzpatrick, Muhammad Wilkerson every week. About things that are maybe not related to football. So I'm curious for you, you know, you've been on this beat for a very long time. You know, you and Rich Cimini are stalwarts of this beat.
I don't compare to Rich. Rich well, I was in the seventh grade when Rich got on this beat. So.
Rich essentially has a locker at Florham Park, I think, at this point. I think he's just permanent. I think he's a permanent fixture. But Why did you want to get into journalism? Was it something that you always wanted to do? Was it a happy accident? How did you end up, you know, being a sports reporter?
Well, I always loved sports, and I wasn't very good at math, so I gravitated toward writing, and, you know, it was something I pretty much identified early on in, like, high school that, you know, I'm not going to make the NFL, or I'm not going to be, you know, playing Major League Baseball, so maybe this is a way I could be around it and do something I love to do, which is write. And so that started my path. I went to Penn State, and I covered sports there, which was a great place because it was basically like you were covering, you know, a major college. You were doing the job that you were – it wasn't going to be much different when you became a professional from doing it in college for the Daily Collegian there, which has turned out a lot of great people, including Jenny Varentis, who used to be on the Jets beat. She worked there, and Tom Verducci at Sports Illustrated. A lot of great – grads from the Daily Collegian. So I did it there, and then, you know, I bounced around for a while to some different papers, covered some different things. And I've been at the Post since 2004. I've covered basically everything you can cover at one point or another. I've done three Olympics. I did the Yankees for a while, and, you know, I think I did the Jets on and off. I backed up Mark Canizero when he was there doing the beat, and then I took over in 2011. So it's been a playoff drought ever since I took over the beat.
so it's your fault.
Yep, you can blame me. But, you know, it's funny, you know, when you tell people what you do and you see that reaction people get, it reminds you of how lucky we are to have these jobs. And I get paid to write about sports. And I try not to forget that. Sometimes you can. There are stressful elements of the job, and there are things that make you want to complain. But you have to try to remember how lucky you are to have one of these jobs.
Yeah, I don't talk about my day job often on the show, but it's one of those things. I'm in charge of hiring interns at NBC Sports for the news desk, and I keep telling people, like, one of the reasons why it's a lot of extra work, but one of the reasons why I really enjoy it is, like, these kids, the first time they put their byline on something, it's like they just had their first kid. It's like the happiest moment of their lives, and you're like, you just get reminded about how cool these things are and how cool it is to be able to do this stuff. I'm curious. You've done so many things. You've covered so many sports. You've covered different locker rooms. What is different besides the macho element, besides the, you know, the bigger teams? What is different about covering football? And actually, what was your favorite sport/team to cover? Do you have a favorite, like, you're going to look back on and be like, wow, that season or that team was special or different or super interesting?
Not really a team that stands out. I mean, covering Phelps at the 2008 Olympics was amazing. And Usain Bolt, that whole the Beijing Olympics was amazing for me. I mean, I saw Phelps win a race in the morning because they would do the races in the morning in Beijing, so they'd be on TV here at night because it was a 12-hour time difference live. And if you remember, Phelps won one race where he touched his fingertips to the wall right before another guy. I covered that race in the morning, and then I covered Usain Bolt at night when weighing the 100-meter, and it was like, you know, it was just an unbelievable day. Like,
that's a hell of a day. That's a day you write home.
Yeah. That's a day where I looked at it like, oh, my God. And there's moments like that, you know, Super Bowls are like that, too. Or, at the 2010 Olympics that covered the hockey between U.S. and Canada, and you realize this is the greatest sporting event in the world right now, and you're at it. Like, and it's just amazing to be at something like that. And the Super Bowl feels a lot like that, too. You know, I like the Jets teams. You know, I covered the Jets, the 2011-2012 were some challenging years to cover because it was a lot going on, but I really liked some of those players I got to know well during that time, my first few years on the beat, and it was just nonstop, you know, interesting things going on. So I really liked those years. But the NFL, the biggest difference to me in the NFL and other sports is the culture of secrecy. You know, it kind of trickles down from the head coach. It's just, you know, they're so into getting a strategic edge over another team that there's just so much secrecy, you know. And yeah, we saw this week the Buffalo Bills media policy, you know, that got a lot of attention, and that's based in that. So we don't want anyone to know that Tyrod Taylor threw an interception in practice. Like, what is that going to do for you? How is that going to win you a game? But it makes me laugh sometimes. It's frustrating at other times. But, you know, baseball, there's no the strategy, you know, when a guy is probably going to call for a bunt or call for an intentional walk, the strategy isn't some big secret. So it's a lot looser.
Right.
You can learn a lot more in baseball from the manager, the coaches and things, and they can kind of teach you the game more, which I wish we had a little bit more in football. But the coaches are just so secretive, and it kind of trickles down to everyone in the organization.
Yeah, and I imagine that makes it hard to get to know players and to establish those relationships depending on the coach in charge and the atmosphere in the locker room. You mentioned, you know, your first couple years on the beat and getting to know guys. When you're walking into a locker room, you know, whether you're first year or second year, when you're trying to create a relationship with these guys and you're trying to establish yourself as not just another microphone, but, you know, to try to get them to open up more, how do you do that? What's your method? What's your way to get to know these guys and to try to get them to, you know, maybe share a little bit more than that stock quote that they were told to tell you?
Yeah, it's hard. I think you look for common ground, you know, maybe you had a shared experience or, you know, someone, you know, something like that. And I think it's really just over time. You know, my approach is always just trying to earn their respect and make sure that they see I'm not out to just write a sensational story. It's gotten more challenging in recent years with the headlines on the websites. You know, there's guys, I think this is something fans don't understand, and I get a lot of on Twitter. I write the story, right? And then I email it to my editors, and then now there's people who are web editors who they put it up on the website and they write that headline. The writers have nothing to do with that. Some writers might have some leeway, but at the Post, they write it. And their job is to get as many people to click on that story as possible. And they shouldn't twist words. They shouldn't do anything wrong. They shouldn't misquote people. But, you know, one of their primary thoughts in their head is, what can I write that's going to draw people in? And sometimes that leads to problems. So that's something I see a lot on Twitter. They get mad about the headline. And
right.
Sometimes I change the headline when I tweet it out, and sometimes I miss it. But, you know, and that can complicate a relationship with a player. There's some players who read everything, and they get upset when they see these headlines sometimes. And I'm finding now with this generation of players who have kind of grown up with social media, they're on their phones just constantly. And so they tend to read a lot more and see a lot more. And, you know, that can sometimes complicate things a little bit.
Do you think social media has made... I'm not going to say better or easier, but do you think that social media has hurt journalism?
To some degree, yeah. I think it's a combination. I think two things have hurt journalism. I think social media has a little bit, and the shrinking of the industry has hurt too. The cutbacks and things. There's not as many people working anymore, and the social media aspect of it, in and of itself, I don't think it's hurting, but what happens is you're just stretched very thin now. It used to be, you know, when I first started in this business, like, God, I sound old. you went and you wrote one or two stories for the newspaper, and you kind of, you know, came up with ideas. And really it was like this. They were posting stories on the web some of these years, but it really, you weren't thinking, like, I got to write this for the website until, late 2006, 2007, I guess it really kicked in. But now it's like, okay, give us something for the website at noon. Then, you know, see if anything else develops. Then you're writing something else for the paper. You're tweeting the whole time. You know, if something comes up, you're going to blog it. I haven't really gotten into the video end of things as much. I haven't been asked to, but some of these guys now, you know, Dennis Wozak from the Associated Press, who does a great job, he has a camera on a selfie stick. He's walking around the locker room because the AP wants video. And so he has to shoot his own video. So you've gone now from, you know, just going and asking questions and writing two stories to doing all these other things. And it's hard to keep the quality as high when you're doing so many things. So I think that aspect is hurt. And then the other thing with Twitter is the quest to be first, you know, leads to some sloppiness. You're not able to report things out as much as you used to.
Yeah, no, that's those are all fair points. It's having been in this business, and I know this is a little nerdy and some fans may or may not like this, but it's interesting. And the other thing that I think has kind of changed thing in social media, and I know Joe Caparoso of Turn on the Jets has written about how social media has impacted being a fan and being a reporter and being a blogger and all that.
Yeah.
But the thing that stepped out to me is I think that more people are better with admitting that they're fans. And I think that maybe it's just because this is the age I grew up in. You know, I'm only 32. I grew up in, you know, I remember before the internet, but I mean, this is an era where fans are reporters too, and fans are bloggers and fans are writers. And I think that, you know, there was a long time where people are like, when this started happening, where people are like, you can't be a fan.
Journalism. I mean, I'm not a fan. You know, like, that's the journalism aspect of it. Like, people always say, like, you're a Jets writer, you should root for the Jets. That's one common misconception. I don't root for them or against them. I don't care.
Right.
You know, I'm completely impartial. But, yeah, like, fan blogs, of course, they're going to be fans of the team. And I think you get a different perspective from them and a different, totally, you know, different content than you might get from a beat writer. And I think there's room for everybody. I think we've learned that. I think there used to be this kind of idea of us versus them. And now, you know, I think there's room for everyone. And even among the beat writers, people do their jobs differently. And you can get different content from different places. And for some of these guys, there's a lot of pressure on them for volume that they have to do 14 posts a day to their website, you know, so their stuff might be a little different than what I'm doing. And, you know, I have the freedom to write columns sometimes, which are different than just reports. So, you know, in that aspect of it, and I don't know if I would say that social media as much as the web has kind of opened things up with the fan bloggers and given more people a voice and more people a chance at reporting on stuff.
Yeah, I could go on for this for a very long time. It's something that fascinates me, and I'm sure I'll get an episode where I get to just rant about this or talk about this for a while. But I'm going to ask you a couple quick questions, silly, stupid questions, and then we'll let you get out of here.
Okay.
First one, if you had to be trapped on a desert island with one other person from the Jets beat, who would it be and why?
One other person from the Jets beat. Oh, man, that's tough. I would go with, I think I'd probably go with Kimberly Martin from Newsday, because I could look at her a lot longer than any of the other guys on the beat if I was stuck on a desert island. I'll probably get in trouble for saying that.
Don't worry, no one listens to this thing, so it's fine. You can say whatever you want. All right, fair. One other question. I'm going to work on this. I'm hopefully going to have like 5 questions by the end of the summer for people, but right now I only have 2. My other question is, if it was your last meal and you had to choose between pizza or tacos, which are you choosing?
I saw you doing this on Twitter. Tacos. I'm a taco guy. Mexican food is my weakness. So that's why I got on you too when you didn't include empanadas in the great list of Mexican foods.
That's fair. I will own the empanadas, but I feel like that's a little pan Latin. Like I feel like
I got that. Yeah, I'm not a world traveler. If I go to a Mexican restaurant in North Jersey, I'm getting empanadas. So that's kind of where I was coming from on that.
Listen, Brian, we got to send you to places better than that. We got to find you, like, there are good taco spots in North Jersey, like little delis that serve great tacos. I can send you some.
I go to Rex's place. That Rex was an expert on Mexican food. The Red Cadillac in Union is very good. I like that place.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Brian, I appreciate you answering my silly questions. I appreciate you filling in for the other Brian on the show. I appreciate you weathering the storm on Twitter, even when it's when it's undeserved. And thank you for being a little bit of a journalist nerd with me and indulging my impulses.
No problem. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your day. Folks, that'll do it for us for this week. You can always find us on iTunes, on SoundCloud, on Stitcher, on Audio Boom, all those wonderful places. Make sure you follow Brian at Brian_Bassett. I'm at Corey Griffin, NBC. Brian is at Brian Koz with a Z. We'll be back next week, but until then, keep calm and jet on.
This has been the Jets Blog Podcast, part of the SNY.TV Audio Network.